layer cake, assorted pies, coffee, tea, milk or buttermilk, 75 cents. From a newspaper ad for a Sacramento, California restaurant in 1925. Ain't We Got Fun? A lot of people think the Roaring Twenties was a decade in which everyone spent a huge amount of time dancing the Charleston and drinking. That, of course, isn't true. People also went to the movies, listened to the radio, read, and played games. The decade, in fact, was marked by an explosion of popular culture, pushed by the development of mass media, which was pushed by post-war advances in technology. Going to the movies. By the mid-1920s, movie making was one of the top five industries in the country in terms of capital investment. A former farm community in California called Hollywood recently had become the film capital of the world. In 1928, America had 20,000 movie theaters and movie houses that looked like ornate palaces and seated thousands of patrons were built in every major city. Millions of Americans flocked each week to see stars like Charlie Chaplin and Rudolph Valentino on the silent screen. In 1927, with the release of The Jazz Singer, the screen was no longer silent, and the talkies made the movies even more popular. Perhaps fittingly, the first words spoken in the first talkie were, wait a minute, you ain't heard nothing yet. Movies and their stars had a huge impact on the culture of the 20s. They influenced fashion, hairstyles, speech patterns and sexual mores, and reinforced cultural and racial stereotypes and prejudices. Clara Bow. One producer said Clara Bow danced even while she was standing still, and the writer F. Scott Fitzgerald called her someone to stir every pulse in the nation. She was the movie's first true female sex symbol. Bow was born in 1905 in Brooklyn to an alcoholic father and a mother so unbalanced she tried to cut Bo's throat when she learned her daughter was going into movies. By the time she was 25, Bo had already starred in almost 50 films and was making as much as $7,500 a week. Moreover, she was the ultimate 1920s flapper, the it girl, it referring to sex appeal, who did what she wanted, when she wanted, and with whom she wanted. Personal scandals and the coming of sound to movies, she had a thick Brooklyn accent, marked the end of Bo's career in 1933. She married a cowboy star named Rex Bell, who later became Lieutenant Governor of Nevada, and was in and out of mental institutions until her death in 1965. Like many of her successors, it's questionable how much Bo really liked the role of femme fatale. "The more I see of men," she once observed, "the more I like dogs." Listening to the radio. At the beginning of the 1920s, radio was entirely for amateurs. Ham operators listened mostly to messages from ships at sea over homemade sets. But in 1920, the Westinghouse Company in Pittsburgh established the first commercial radio station, KDKA. Almost overnight, stations sprang up all over the country. By 1924, there were more than 500 stations, and by 1927, the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, had organized a 19-station national broadcasting company, NBC. Remember, radio brought major sporting events and election returns live into American homes. It also encouraged the makers of soap, the sellers of life insurance, and the purveyors of cornflakes to reach out to consumers over the airwaves. U.S. business had its first true national medium for advertising, and Americans accepted that the price of free radio was commercials. By 1929, more than 12 million American families had radio sets. Radio? It stinks. What have you done with my child? You have sent him out on the street in rags of ragtime to collect money. You have made him a laughingstock of intelligence. Surely, a stench in the nostrils of the gods of the ionosphere. Dr. Lee DeForest, inventor and guiding force behind long-distance radio transmissions, objecting in 1928 to the commercialization of the medium. Listening to music and writing literature. Radio, along with the increasing popularity of the phonograph, made popular music even more popular. The hottest sound was called jazz, which stressed improvisation and rhythm as well as melody. This sound had its roots deep in the musical traditions of African Americans. Its stars included Bessie Smith, Ferdinand Jelly Roll Morton, and Louis Armstrong, and it was a key part of what became known as the Harlem Renaissance, a confluence of African American genius in the arts that flourished in the 1920s in New York City. Jazz became wildly popular in other parts of the world as well, and was recognized as the first truly unique form of American music. Literature, on the other hand, was most heavily influenced by writers who were disillusioned with post-war America, or who chose to satirize Americans' seeming penchant for conformity. These writers included novelists F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Great Gatsby, 1925, Sinclair Lewis, Babbitt, 1922, and Ernest Hemingway, A Farewell to Arms, 1929. Playwright Eugene O'Neill, Strange Interlude, 1928, and poets E.E. Cummings, Carl Sandburg, and Langston Hughes. Playing games. When it wasn't being entertained, America was seemingly entertaining itself in the 1920s, so much so that one contemporary observer called it the Age of Play. Shorter work days and weeks and more disposable income, or at least what seemed like more disposable income, gave Americans more time and money to enjoy themselves. Sports like golf and tennis boomed. Public playgrounds for kids became popular. Crossword puzzles and a game called Mahjong were all the rage. Tiled out. Parlor games have come and gone in American culture, but the Mahjong craze of the 1920s may have been the only one to require costumes. An ancient Chinese game played with a set of 144 colored tiles, Mahjong hit the West Coast in 1922 and soon became immensely fashionable across the nation. Many women refused to play, however, unless they were suitably attired in elaborate Oriental robes. So many Mahjong sets were being produced at the height of the craze that Chinese manufacturers ran out of the traditional calf shins they made the tiles from. As a result, they were forced to ask Chicago slaughterhouses for cow bones. The fad faded after about 5 years of wild popularity. One possible reason was ennui created by confusion. By mid-decade, more than 20 different sets of rules for the game had been published. Drying out America, Prohibition begins. Even before the country's formal inception, Americans had been a hard-drinking bunch, and the social and private costs they paid for it had been high. But on January 16, 1920, the nation undertook a noble experiment to rid itself of the effects of demon rum. It was called Prohibition, and it was a spectacular failure. There is some statistical evidence that Americans drank less after Prohibition started than they did before it began. But overall, the ban on booze was a bad idea. For one thing, it encouraged otherwise law-abiding citizens to visit speakeasies where alcohol was sold illegally. The number of speaks in New York City at the end of the decade, for example, was probably double the number of legal saloons at the beginning. Gangsters like Scarface Al Capone and George Bugs Moran made fortunes selling bootleg booze, and they became celebrities doing it, despite the violence that was their normal business tool. Capone's Chicago mob took in $60 million a year at its peak and murdered more than 300 people doing it. But bullets weren't the gangsters' only tools. They also bought off or bullied scores of federal, state, and local officials to look the other way, which only added to the public disrespect for law and government. Remember, part of the disrespect for government was well-deserved. Even though Congress and a string of presidents paid lip service to the idea of prohibition to make the anti-liquor lobby happy, many of the politicians were regular customers for the bootleggers. Congress provided only 1,550 federal agents to enforce the ban throughout the entire country, and criminal penalties for bootlegging were relatively light. Over one two-year period in New York, 7,000 prohibition-related arrests were made, with only 17 convictions. Some states, in fact, passed laws restricting state and local police from actively enforcing the ban. George Remus. He was known as the King of Bootleggers, an attorney whose most famous client turned out to be himself. Remus was born in Germany in 1876 and came to America when he was 5 years old. He trained as a pharmacist but became a lawyer in 1900 and specialized in criminal defense. When Prohibition began, his clients were often bootleggers, and Remus observed that the occupation paid a lot more than practicing law. Moving to Cincinnati, which was near most of the major distilleries that could still legally make alcohol for medicinal purposes, Remus used his pharmacist's license to buy huge amounts of legal alcohol. Then, he had an army of employees steal it on the way to his warehouses and turn it into illegal hooch. Despite 5 arrests, Remus lived a lavish life, complete with a $125,000 swimming pool at his mansion. He once threw a party where each of the 200 guests received diamond jewelry or cars. During one of his jail stints, Remus's wife took up with a federal prohibition agent. On his release from prison, Remus promptly shot and killed his errant spouse. Acting as his own attorney, he pleaded temporary insanity and was acquitted after the jury deliberated all of 19 minutes. Remus eventually retired from bootlegging when the business got too violent for him. He died in 1952 at the age of 75. One more thing. The King of Bootleggers never touched the stuff himself. Changing morals. At the time, many observers saw Americans' unenthusiasm for prohibition as an example of the country's slipping morals. So, they observed, was the behavior of young people. Perhaps more than any generation before them, the youth of the 1920s embraced their own music, fashion, and speech. The automobile gave them a way to get away from home, at least temporarily, and also a place to be sexually intimate. Other things contributed to the shifting moral patterns of the times. The sexy images from Hollywood, the growing availability of birth control devices, the use of sex by advertisers to sell everything from cars to toothpaste, and the growing emancipation of women. Remember, there was no question, however, that the inequalities between the sexes continued. Women made less than men in the same jobs and were still subject to a double standard that their place was in the home with the kids. But women now had the right to vote, and more of them were entering the workplace, from 8.4 million in 1920 to 10.6 million in 1930. Short-haired, short-skirted young women, referred to as flappers, flaunted their freedom to smoke and drink and go out with men alone without the certainty of being morally condemned as loose. And perhaps most important, fewer of them cared if they were. Girls just want to have more. The outstanding characteristic of the flapper is not her uniform, but her independence and will to be prosperous. They no longer marry men who merely support them. they have awakened to the fact that the superior sex stuff is all bunk. Journalist Samuel Crowther, 1926. An Age of Heroes. If there was one thing the 1920s had a lot of, it was heroes. The advent of radio and the increasing popularity of national magazines and tabloid magazines provided an arena for stars to shine. And armies of public relations agents pushed and shoved their clients into the spotlight. There were movie stars. Clara Bow reportedly got 45,000 fan letters a week. When screen heartthrob Rudolph Valentino died of a perforated ulcer in 1926, several women reportedly committed suicide. More than 30,000 mourners filed past his $10,000 casket, which had a glass plate above his face so they could have one last look. There were also vaudeville stars like magician Harry Houdini and humorist Will Rogers. Every sport had its own gods or goddesses. In swimming, there were Gertrude Ertl and Johnny Weissmuller. In football, Red Grange and Newt Rockne. In boxing, Jack Dempsey and Gene Tooney. In golf, Bobby Jones. And in tennis, Bill Tilden. And in baseball, there was the moon-faced son of a Baltimore saloon keeper. His name was George Herman Ruth, but everyone called him Babe. For most of the decade, Ruth was perhaps the most photographed man in the world. A fine pitcher, he became the greatest slugger in history and almost single-handedly restored baseball as the national pastime after a fixed World Series in 1919 had threatened to ruin it. Ruth was so popular that when his team, the Yankees, moved into a new stadium in New York, it was dubbed the House That Ruth Built. Remember, but as big as Babe Ruth was, he was only second to a tall, thin, and modest airmail pilot from Michigan named Charles A. Lindbergh. On May 20, 1927, Lindbergh lifted off alone from a New York airfield in a $6,000 plane laden with gasoline and sandwiches. When reporters asked him if sandwiches were all he was taking to eat, Lindy replied, "If I get to Paris, I won't need any more, and if I don't, I won't need any more either." Lindbergh headed over the Atlantic, and 33.5 hours later, he landed in Paris. He was proclaimed the first man to fly nonstop between the two continents. The world went nuts. Lindbergh was mobbed everywhere he went. In New York City alone, an estimated 4 million people turned out for a parade and celebration in his honor. In later years, Lindbergh's luster was badly tarnished by his pre-World War II enthusiasm for Hitler's Germany. But his flight proved a giant shot in the arm for aviation, even though Lindbergh somewhat prudently returned from France by ship. Suddenly, flying wasn't so scary. By the end of the decade, more than 40 U.S. airplane companies were carrying close to 200,000 passengers per year. Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis wasn't the only thing in the air as the 1920s came to a close. The economy continued to hum along at a frenetic pace as well. Stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau, said Yale economics professor Irving Fisher on October 16, 1929. 8 days later, the plateau collapsed. An overinflated stock market crashed, costing investors $15 billion in a week. America was plunged into an economic mess, the likes of which it had never seen. Chapter 15. Uncle Sam's Depressed, 1930 to 1940. In this chapter, enduring the Great Depression, fashioning a New Deal, failing minorities, dealing with naysayers, crusaders, nuts, and desperados. During one of his last speeches as president in December 1928, Calvin Coolidge noted that America could regard the present with satisfaction and anticipate the future with optimism. Much of the country did both. But as the 1930s dawned, it became painfully apparent that Americans had been prematurely satisfied and overly optimistic. This chapter takes a look at what triggered the Great Depression and what it meant. You also meet Franklin Roosevelt, another of those great men who seem to come along every now and then in American history, just when the country needs them. For a more detailed look at this era, see Lessons from the Great Depression for Dummies, written by Steve Wiegand, that's me, and published by Wiley. The Great Depression, Causes and Consequences. America had gone through economic hard times before. There had been bank panics, recessions, and boom and bust cycles of varying degrees of severity and length triggered by political battles, the collapse of particular industries, or world events. Never did it suffer an economic illness so deep and so long as the Great Depression of the 1930s. Economists have argued ever since as to just what caused it, but it's safe to say that a bunch of intertwined factors contributed. Among them were bank failures. Many small banks, particularly in rural areas, had overextended credit to farmers, who, for the most part, had not shared in the prosperity of the 1920s and often couldn't repay the loans. Big banks, meanwhile, had foolishly made huge loans to foreign countries. Why? So the foreign countries could repay their earlier debts from World War I. When times got tough and U.S. banks stopped lending, European nations simply defaulted on their outstanding loans. As a result, many banks went bankrupt. Others were forced out of business when depositors panicked and withdrew their money. The closings and panics almost completely shut down the country's banking system. Environmental disasters. The vast production of crops during World War I and the decade that followed contributed to what already had been decades of overplowing much of America's farmland. The prairie grasses that held topsoil in place were stripped. Coupled with one of the worst droughts in recorded history, the unprotected soil turned the Great Plains into what would become known as the Dust Bowl. Dry winds picked up tons of topsoil and blew it across the prairies, creating huge, suffocating clouds of dirt that turned farms into deserts. Farm failures. Even before the Depression and Dust Bowl disasters, farmers were having hard times, mostly because they were producing too much and product prices were too low. The situation was so bad in some areas that farmers burned corn for fuel rather than sell it. Government inaction. Rather than try to jumpstart the economy through public works programs or financial system reforms, President Herbert Hoover's first instinct was to handle the financial crisis by largely ignoring it. He insisted the U.S. economic system was fundamentally sound and would get better by itself. By the time the federal government began taking small, tentative actions, it was too little, too late. The stock market crash. The stock market soared throughout much of the 1920s, and the more it grew, the more people eagerly poured money into it. Many bought on margin, which meant they paid only part of a stock's price when they bought it and the rest when they sold it. That worked fine as long as stock prices kept going up. When the market crashed in late October 1929, they were forced to pay up on stocks that were worth far less than what they had paid for them. Many had borrowed to buy stock, and when the stock market went belly up, they couldn't repay their loans. Lenders were left holding the empty bag. Too many poor people. That may sound goofy, but it's a real reason. Though the overall economy had soared in the 1920s, most of the wealth was enjoyed by relatively few Americans. In 1929, 40% of the families in the country were still living at or below the poverty level. That made them too poor to buy goods and services, and too poor to pay their debts. With no markets for their goods, manufacturers laid off tens of thousands of workers, which, of course, just created more poor people. Remember, whatever the causes, the consequences of the Great Depression were staggering. In the cities, thousands of jobless men roamed the streets looking for work. It wasn't unusual for 2,000 or 3,000 applicants to show up for one or two job openings. If they weren't looking for work, they were looking for food. Bread lines were established to prevent people from starving. And more than 1 million families lost their houses and took up residence in shanty towns made up of tents, packing crates, and the hulks of old cars. They were called Hoovervilles, a mocking reference to President Hoover, whom many blamed for the mess the country was in. Americans weren't sure what to do. In the summer of 1932, about 20,000 desperate World War I veterans marched on Washington, D.C., to claim $1,000 bonuses they had been promised they would get, starting in 1946. When Congress refused to move up the payment schedules, several thousand members of the Bonus Army built a camp of tents and shacks on the banks of the Potomac River and refused to leave. Under orders of President Hoover, federal troops commanded by General Douglas MacArthur used bayonets and gas bombs to rout the squatters. The camp was burned. No one was killed, but the episode left a bad taste in the mouths of many Americans. Thousands of farmers left their homes in states like Oklahoma and Arkansas and headed for the promise of better days in the West, especially California. What they found there, however, was often a back-breaking existence as migrant workers, living in squalid camps and picking fruit for starvation wages. Technical stuff. Plus to minus. If you doubt that the Great Depression deserves that great adjective, look at these numbers. More than 5,000 banks closed between 1930 and 1933. 9 million savings accounts were wiped out, and depositors lost $2.5 billion. Unemployment rose from less than 1 million in 1929 to more than 12 million by 1933, equal to about 25% of the total U.S. workforce. Capital investment dropped from $10 billion in 1929 to $1 billion in 1932, and the stock market's industrial index dropped from 452 in September 1929 to 58 in July 1932. The gross national product went from $104 billion in 1929 to $59 billion in 1932. Farm income dropped 60% in the 3 years after 1929. In 1932, per capita income from farming was only $80 a year for farmers. The Lindbergh kidnapping. Almost everybody loved Charles Lindbergh. The lanky aviator had remained a true American hero after his historic solo flight across the Atlantic in 1927. So it made national headlines in March 1932 when someone climbed in a second-story window of Lindbergh's Hopewell, New Jersey home and snatched his 20-month-old son, Charles Jr. The nation held its breath for 6 weeks, during which time Lindbergh responded to a ransom demand by paying $50,000. But on May 12th, the body of the missing baby was found in the woods about 5 miles from the Lindbergh home. An illegal immigrant and escaped convict from Germany named Bruno Richard Hauptmann was arrested for the crime after most of the ransom money was found in his garage. Hauptmann was convicted and executed in the electric chair in 1936, still declaring his innocence. As a result of the crime, Congress passed what became known as the Lindbergh Law, which made kidnapping a federal crime and thus allowed the FBI to enter the hunt for kidnappers. FDR, making alphabet soup. In 1932, Herbert Hoover was the U.S. president. In 1933, he was toast. Much of the country blamed Hoover for the Depression, although the groundwork for it had been laid long before he was elected in 1928. Hoover's big mistake was that he kept saying things would get better if everyone was just a little patient. And things just got worse. Electing a reformer. By the time the 1932 presidential election came along, it was pretty clear that the Democrats could nominate a dead dog and still beat Hoover. Fortunately for the country, they passed up deceased canines and chose the governor of New York. His name was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, an appellation reduced in newspaper headlines and the popular parlance to FDR. Eleanor Roosevelt. She began her marriage to her distant cousin in his shadow and became his legs. She also became one of the most beloved and hated first ladies in U.S. history. Eleanor was born into a wealthy New York family in 1884. After an unhappy childhood marked by the death of her parents, she married Franklin in 1905. Over the next decade, Eleanor had six children, found out her husband was playing around, and seemed destined to be either divorced or in the background as a politician's wife. But Eleanor rose to the occasion. As First Lady, she broke tradition and held more than 350 press conferences of her own, but for female journalists only. She was a tireless champion of civil rights and women's issues, and often represented her husband, whose polio prevented him from traveling easily, around the country. But her activism also earned her vitriolic hatred from people who didn't like her husband, her politics, or the fact that she was an independent woman. After FDR's death, Eleanor served as a U.S. delegate to the United Nations and as a roving ambassador at large. She died in 1962 at the age of 78. A distant cousin of Theodore Roosevelt and the only son of a wealthy railroad executive, FDR attended the best private schools and graduated from Harvard. Trained as a lawyer, Roosevelt served in the state legislature, became Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and had a boundless future. Then in 1921, he was struck by polio and crippled. But Roosevelt had an indomitable spirit. He was elected New York's governor in 1928, earning a reputation as a reformer. The Democrats nominated him for the presidency in 1932 after some behind-the-scenes maneuvering by newspaper publisher William Randolph Hearst and business tycoon Joseph Kennedy. He campaigned on a New Deal platform and easily defeated Hoover. Despite his aristocratic background, Roosevelt was wildly popular with the average guy, many of whom didn't know he could walk only with leg braces and crutches. News photographers and newsreel cameramen took care not to take shots of him in awkward poses. But many conservatives and business leaders, who considered him a traitor to his class, hated him. FDR may have been the perfect president for the time. He was friendly and approachable and exuded sympathy and self-confidence. He knew how to compromise, and like Lincoln and Washington, he knew how to get the best out of people. He was lucky. Before taking office, he narrowly escaped an assassin's bullets while riding in a car with Chicago Mayor Anton Cermak in Miami. Cermak was killed. He wasn't afraid to do something, even if it proved to be wrong. "Take a method," he said, "and try it. If it fails, try another. But above all, do something." Who's afraid of a little depression? First of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror that paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance. Franklin Roosevelt, Inaugural Address, March 4, 1933. We ain't gonna die out. People is going on. Changing a little, maybe, but going right on. Maud Jode in John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, 1939. Creating Hope Through a New Deal. Roosevelt heeded his own advice and did something. Supported by healthy Democratic majorities in Congress, FDR pushed through a dazzling array of programs, many of them best known for their initials, in his first 100 days in office. The products of the first 100 days, and in some cases a bit longer, included the Agricultural Adjustment Act, AAA. Basically, it paid farmers not to produce so much food. That bailed farmers out, at least a little, and increased farm prices to more profitable levels. Civil Works Administration, CWA. The CWA provided about 4 million jobs in building roads, airports, schools, sewer systems, and other civic projects. Civilian Conservation Corps, CCC. This created 1,300 camps around the country to give young men new jobs at $30 a month, with $22 sent home to their families in conserving natural resources. By 1941, the CCC employed 2.5 million men who planted more than 17 million trees and made improvements in scores of states and national parks. Emergency Banking Act. 3 days after he took office, FDR closed all banks. Then, on March 9th, he pushed through Congress a bill that reopened the banks under close supervision. The bill, which took all of 8 hours to go through, also authorized the Treasury to issue more currency. Federal Emergency Relief Act, FERA. The FERA eventually provided a total of $500 million in aid to state and local governments. Glass-Steagall Banking Act. This act mandated that banks get out of the investment business and restricted use of bank money on stock speculation. It also created federal guarantees for personal bank accounts. Homeowners Loan Act. This provided funds to help keep homeowners from losing their homes to mortgage foreclosures. Natural Industrial Recovery Act, NERA. This ambitious program was designed to get industries to cooperate in setting maximum hours, minimum wages, and price controls through an organization called the National Recovery Administration, NRA. The NERA was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1935 for giving too much power to the program's non-government administrators. Tennessee Valley Authority Act, TVA. One of the most innovative of the New Deal programs, the TVA created an independent public agency that oversaw the development of dams and other projects in the Tennessee River Valley. The TVA covered 40,000 square miles in 7 states. It built 16 dams, took over 5 more, and provided electric power to 40,000 families who previously had none. The TVA also supplied fertilizer, provided flood control and better river navigation, and reforested vast areas. Truth and Securities Act. This act required new stocks and bonds offered for sale to be registered with the new Securities Exchange Commission, SEC, and required brokers to fully disclose all background information. Work Projects Administration, WPA. This organization created a host of federal projects that ranged from cleaning slums and providing electricity to rural areas, to painting murals on the walls of public buildings and putting on plays for audiences who paid only what they could afford. In 1935, Roosevelt added to his alphabet soup of programs by getting Congress to pass the Social Security Act, which began a sweeping federal system of unemployment insurance and retirement pensions paid for by both employers and employees through payroll taxes. In 1938, he signed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which created a national minimum wage of 25 cents per hour and a maximum work week of 44 hours. By the time the 1936 elections rolled around, things were looking up. Unemployment had dropped from 12 million to about 9 million. Average weekly earnings had increased from $17 to $22. So despite Republican predictions that the Democrats were creating a socialist state, FDR was easily reelected. Harry Hopkins. He was the big dealer in the New Deal, a super social worker who was Franklin Roosevelt's most trusted aide and whose no BS approach to things earned him the nickname Lord Root of the Matter from Winston Churchill. Hopkins was born the son of a harness maker in Iowa in 1890. After graduating from college, he became a social worker and eventually ran relief programs in New York for FDR when Roosevelt was governor. In the White House, Hopkins ran several New Deal programs and agencies and was made Secretary of Commerce in 1938. He wasn't shy about spending government money either. One Hopkins-run program spent $1 billion in less than 6 months, making even FDR wince. When a New Deal congressional critic suggested there were better ways to deal with the Depression in the long run, Hopkins snapped, "People don't eat in the long run, Senator. They eat every day." When World War II broke out, Hopkins served as FDR's alter ego and go-between with other world leaders. After FDR's death, Hopkins helped plan the United Nations. Never in good health, he died in 1946 at the age of 55. Packing the Supreme Court. One of the things that stuck in FDR's craw during his first term was the 9-member U.S. Supreme Court. Dominated by conservatives, the court had thwarted some of Roosevelt's plans. So in February 1937, he proposed that he be allowed to appoint a new federal judge for every judge who refused to retire within 6 months of reaching the age of 70. This court-packing tactic would have raised the number of Supreme Court justices to 15. Roosevelt's ploy worked. Sort of. Although Congress ultimately rejected it, the High Court began making decisions that were more favorable to the New Deal. Within a few years, 6 justices retired, enabling Roosevelt to appoint liberals to the court. But the fight also weakened FDR politically because it was widely viewed as a presidential power play. The Birth of a Hero. You may have read that Superman was born on the planet Krypton, but it was really in Cleveland, Ohio, on a hot summer night in 1934. And his parents were a couple of teenagers looking for careers in Depression-ravaged America. Jerry Siegel was a 19-year-old would-be writer who dallied in science fiction. His pal, 19-year-old Joe Shuster, was an artist. So when Siegel came up during a sleepless night with an idea for a character with superpowers, the two decided to put together a comic strip. They dressed their hero in a red, blue, and yellow costume and took him around to every comic strip syndicate in America and were rejected faster than a speeding bullet. In 1938, however, DC Comics decided to take a chance, and Superman appeared for the first time in Action Comics No. 1, a near-mint copy of which sold in 2014 for $3.2 million. Siegel and Shuster got relatively little for their creation, despite decades of legal battles over who owned the rights to the Kryptonian Crusader. Created as an antidote for Depression Blues, the Man of Steel has become an icon, perhaps second only to Mickey Mouse as a larger-than-life pen and ink character. And who knows? Without him, we might not have Super Bowls, superstars, or supersized fast food meals. Assessing the New Deal. How well the New Deal actually worked is still widely debated. Many of the programs had big price tags. The national debt, which was about $22.5 billion when FDR took office, was nearly double that by 1940, and so was the size of the federal bureaucracy. After winning re-election in 1936, FDR began scaling back federal spending to help keep inflation in check. As soon as he did, unemployment began to climb again, and industrial production slowed down. What is undebatable, however, is the fact that the New Deal greatly increased the role of the federal government in people's lives. It laid the foundation for a government safety net of services for Americans most in need. It fostered the development of the modern labor movement, and it made the federal government a key player in regulating the U.S. economy. And whether all that was a good or bad idea, most people felt a lot better in 1940 than they did in 1932. Americans were pleased enough, in fact, with FDR's performance by 1940 to give him what they had given no other president, a third term. Shoving aside racial minorities. The majority of America's minorities had never had it good, so it's not surprising that the Depression made their lot even more miserable. More than half of African Americans still lived in the South, most as sharecroppers, meaning they farmed someone else's land. Almost all of those who worked and weren't farmers held menial jobs that whites hadn't wanted, until the Depression came along. When it did, the African Americans were shoved out of their jobs. As many as 400,000 left the South for cities in the North, which didn't help much. By 1932, it's estimated that half of the black U.S. population was on some form of relief. Segregation continued in nearly every walk of life. Proposals for federal anti-lynching laws were blocked in Congress, and more than 60 blacks were murdered by lynching and other mob violence during the decade. Even some of FDR's bold federal programs blatantly discriminated against blacks. Wage-setting schedules allowed employers to pay black workers less than whites. Farm aid schemes often ignored African-American farmers. And job creation programs provided disproportionately fewer jobs to African-Americans. Remember, some of the programs, however, helped everyone. Segregation in federal jobs slowly began to crumble, and some labor unions opened their membership to minorities. Such crumbs were enough to make many black voters abandon the Republican Party. Since the Civil War, most African-American voters had remained loyal to the GOP, particularly as Democrat-dominated southern states routinely imposed repressive laws and voting rights restrictions. But as the Depression deepened and African-Americans increasingly moved to northern cities, black voters began to shift their allegiance from the party of Lincoln, which they felt had done little for them since Reconstruction, to the party of FDR, which offered at least part of the pie to them. In 1932, only 44% of black voters supported Roosevelt. By 1936, it was 74%. The black vote became one of the Democrats' most reliable blocks of support for decades to come. Other minority groups suffered similarly to African Americans during the decade. Mexico had been exempted from the immigration restrictions of the 1920s, and as a result, hundreds of thousands of Mexicans came to America, mostly to the Southwest. Prior to the Depression, they were at least tolerated as a ready source of cheap labor. In the 1930s, however, they were pushed out of jobs by desperate white Americans. Thousands of Latinos were deported, even some who were U.S. citizens, and as many as 500,000 returned to Mexico. Those of Asian descent, mostly on the West Coast, were likewise forced from jobs or relegated to work only within their own communities. Native Americans had been largely ignored by the federal government for decades. The idea had been to have them gradually disappear into the American mainstream. In 1924, Congress made U.S. citizens of all Native Americans, whether they wanted to be or not. But preliminary studies done in the 1920s found that assimilation had failed. In 1934, Congress changed direction and passed laws that allowed Native Americans to retain their cultural identity. That did little for their economic well-being, and they remained perhaps the worst off of America's minority groups. The Scottsboro Boys. In March 1931, 9 young black males were taken from a freight train near Scottsboro, Alabama, and arrested for vagrancy. Then 2 white women who were traveling in the same freight car accused the boys of gang raping them. Despite mountains of evidence that the women were lying, an all-white jury quickly convicted the youths, and 8 of them were sentenced to death. A communist-backed group called the International Labor Defense took up their cause, and the U.S. Supreme Court ordered a new trial. 5 of them were retried and found guilty again, and again, the verdict was thrown out by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional because blacks had been excluded from the jury. None of the defendants were ever executed. 1 escaped, and the other 4 were paroled after serving years in prison for the crime of being black in the wrong place at the wrong time. In November 2013, the state of Alabama posthumously pardoned the 3 men who had not yet been formally exonerated. The Scottsboro Boys have finally received justice, said Alabama Governor Robert J. Bentley. Keeping women at home or work. With jobs scarce, a strong feeling prevailed that women should stay home and let men have the jobs. There was even a federal rule that 2 people in the same family couldn't be on the government payroll. But 2 things occurred that actually slightly increased the number of women in the workforce during the decade. The first was that women would work for lower pay, a fact that was not only allowed by federal law, but followed by some federal government agencies. The second was that more women had no man to rely on as a breadwinner. U.S. marriage rates dropped for the first time since the early 1800s. Inventing an antidepressant. Charles B. Darrow had known better times. Broke and unemployed in 1933, the Germantown, Pennsylvania heating engineer combined memories of a past family vacation to Atlantic City, New Jersey, with an existing board game called The Landlord's Game. Darrow's version used Atlantic City addresses like Marvin Gardens and Park Place. He called his get-rich-quick real estate board game Monopoly. Darrow took his idea to the folks at the Parker Brothers Game Company in 1934. They promptly kicked him out the door, calling the game too long, too dull, and burdened with at least 52 fundamental play errors. Undaunted, Darrow produced the game on his own and sold 5,000 sets to a Philadelphia department store. The sale changed the mind of Parker Brothers. It bought the game from Darrow in early 1936, bought the rights to the Landlord's Game from its inventor, Elizabeth Maggie, and soon was churning out 20,000 sets of Monopoly a week. People forgot their hard times for a few hours while rolling dice, buying railroads, and going directly to jail without passing go. Monopoly is now sold in more than 100 countries and has been produced in 37 languages and in more than 100 variations, including a game made entirely of chocolate and one with 18-karat gold pieces and real U.S. currency. Darrow retired at 46 on his royalties. He lived to 76, the first American millionaire to make his fortune by designing a game, and in the midst of the Great Depression yet. Developing organized labor. If the sun peeked through the Depression's clouds on anyone, it may have been organized labor. The 1930s saw captains of industry and business lose much of their political clout to unions, and new laws made organizing easier. the decade also saw a telling split in labor. The traditionalists who ran the American Federation of Labor, AFL, wanted to concentrate on organizing workers according to their specific skills or craft. But that left out thousands of workers who had no specific skills and also sometimes pitted workers for the same company against one another. In 1936, John L. Lewis, the bombastic leader of the United Mine Workers, led a split from the AFL and formed the Congress of Industrial Organizations, CIO. The CIO was more receptive to not only unskilled workers, but also women and minorities. By 1938, it had 4 million members. The United Auto Workers, UAW, also flexed its muscles in the decade. The UAW used sit-down strikes, where workers would simply stop and sit down at their posts, making it much more difficult to use strike breakers. In 1937, General Motors, the third largest company in the country, recognized the UAW after a 44-day strike. That same year, steel workers won recognition of their union by U.S. Steel, the giant of the industry. Other steel companies, however, refused to go along, and confrontations were often violent. On Memorial Day, 1937, police opened fire on marching strikers and their families in South Chicago, killing 10 and wounding 90. The tragedy became known as the Memorial Day Massacre and served as a rallying cry for labor. All told, there were more than 4,500 strikes in 1937, and labor won more than three-quarters of them. By 1940, more than 8 million Americans were members of organized labor. Every bit helps. How bad were things in the Great Depression? Consider this Associated Press report that appeared in U.S. newspapers in mid-June 1931. The Presbyterian Missions Board had $3.77 to use for the hungry and unemployed today. A contribution from the Batanga Church in Cameroon, West Africa, which raised the money at a coconut bazaar. The Bulu tribe's newspaper, Ifu, had published an article saying, "There are actually people in America who do not have enough to eat." Pastor Iduma Masumbi and his son, a church elder, concluded aid must be forthcoming to the United States and arranged the church festival. Critics, crooks, and crime fighters. Not everyone was in love with FDR. Many Republicans refused to even say his name, referring to him as that man in the White House. The 1930s also spawned a gaggle of colorful critics and crusaders who made themselves heard above the hard times. Huey Long. He was a traveling salesman, a lawyer, and a world-class demagogue. Huey Long was elected governor of Louisiana in 1928 on a populist platform, and he actually did some good things for the state, such as making school textbooks free and improving roads and highways. But he also ran a corrupt administration that was not above roughing up, blackmailing, or slandering those who opposed him. By 1930, the Kingfish was as close to an absolute dictator as there was in the country. He controlled the legislature and, after winning a U.S. Senate seat, refused to promptly vacate the governor's office, thus holding both jobs for a while. Originally an FDR supporter, Long broke with the White House mostly for egotistical reasons. He proposed a Share Our Wealth program that called for confiscating family fortunes of more than $5 million and annual incomes of over $1 million and guaranteeing every family $2,500 a year, a homestead, and a car. Long had a national following and announced he would run against FDR at the head of a third party in 1936. Private polls showed he might garner 4 million votes, enough to tip the election to the Republicans. But he never got the chance. in September 1935, Long was shot to death on the steps of the Louisiana Capitol by a man whose family he had ruined. A Democratic kingmaker. I'm for the poor man, all poor men. Black and white, they all gotta have a chance. Every man a king, that's my motto. Huey Long to a Journalist, 1932. Francis E. Townsend. Francis Townsend was an elderly California doctor who was selling real estate in Long Beach in 1935 when he had an idea that he just couldn't help sharing, providing $200 a month for life to everyone 60 or older. It would be financed by sales taxes, and every pensioner would have to spend his entire pension every month, which, Townsend said, would stimulate the economy. Actually, more experienced economists pointed out, the scheme would take half the national income to provide for 8% of the population. Despite the crackpot smell of the